Wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
Down in the new basement studios by the lake, this is our summer movie roundup review show thing. So, and you're looking...
Special.
No, it's not a special. We've cut down on specials. Yeah. Long-time listeners know that prior to every summer movie season, so around Memorial Day, my partner and I, we review or preview the summer movies. And along the way, we make predictions about whether something's going to be a hit critically, whether it's going to be a hit financially. And we make predictions. And then every November, we see who the winner is. I think lifetime, I am 0-4-1 or 0-5-1 against my partner. I did get a push one year.
Yeah.
So anyway, today is the roundup show. And also because we're not going to spend the whole show going back and forth about how well we predict films.
Considering we spend two episodes actually doing them.
Actually doing the films, yeah. We are going to do some movie talk based on an article we found in the Washington Post a little while ago.
Yeah. How come you have a paper version? Since when do you actually get a paper?
Every Sunday.
Oh, was this in the Sunday? I didn't realize.
This was in the Sunday. I do not buy the Washington Post in the week. In fact, I very rarely read it, even if it's out somewhere. I get all my news off the internet and therefore other websites. But every Sunday I buy the newspaper, basically because I like to do the crossword.
You're literally like a 70-year-old man.
I am. I did the crossword in the magazine today. I completed it in about an hour. And I sat there and I said very arrogantly in the house, whoever's doing these crosswords needs to start making them tougher. Because if I can do it in an hour, well, then if you're a real like crossword expert, you must be finished in like 15 minutes.
The people who actually do the crosswords, they're getting much older, and so they need to soften them up because their mental acuity is dropping off a bit.
Quite. Anyway, so that's why I still buy the Washington Post on a Sunday.
So we both have it. You're going to hear a lot of paper shuffling today. Yes. Sorry, everybody. We've been trying to do lots of things to improve our sound, but today we won't be able to do anything about the fact we have both have a newspaper in front of us, and then when we talk about our movie predictions, we have a lot of notes.
Do you want to set up this article that we're going to first discuss?
So the idea of the article was it's talking, I don't know, what was the title? I have it folded back.
The New Canon was the title.
That's what I figured.
Written by Anne Hornaday, who, the Post seemed to have about three or four different people who both review movies, but, you know, I think as you get more senior, you get to talk about movies.
Right.
The junior dude actually has to go and watch and go, yeah.
Yeah, she still does individual reviews, but yes, they split it up. Yeah. It used to be back in the day, you'd have multiple people in the paper reviewing the same movies, but now they've pared that down, I guess. Well, the idea is that the canon, meaning the greatest movies of all time, so to speak, at least greatest in terms of artistic merit,
right,
seems pretty solidified for the prior century. You know, Citizen Kane is always right up there. Right. They mentioned in the intro to the article that it was a big thing when somebody came out with a list that actually had Hitchcock Vertigo above Citizen Kane.
Oh, really?
Like, you know, like I was apparently, I mean, it's right there in the article.
I find Vertigo hard work. Have you ever seen Vertigo? I find Rear Window a much more accessible Hitchcock mystery.
Yeah. But lots of movies, and I suppose, you know, some of them are, well, I don't know what else would be in the list. I was thinking of
Bridge Over the River Kwai is one of those films. Lawrence of Arabia,
right? Okay.
Doctor Zhivago. You can. They're all written.
Right,
they're
Doctor all Zhivago, done. That's a good example.
Any you can sort of pair any two of those three. I want to give a shout out to someone who just died the last 10 days or so. By the time you hear this, a famous screenwriter from the 70s, William Goldman, just passed away. He wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. He also was responsible for the script for All the President's Men. So there, in terms of we're talking about great movies from the last century, there are two films there that are probably going to appear at some level. I think he also did films from the 70s such as Marathon Man and stuff like that. So he was a big name in the 70s, but he also did some work later on. But he just passed away. But again, you know, the people often regard, you know, we talk about Citizen Kane and some of the films we've just shouted out. All the President's Men is one of those films, I think, in terms of its film and also what it represents, is one of those films that would forever be on a sort of top 50 list from the first 100 years, Jaws, films like that.
So what this did is it started talking about, okay, you know, understanding and acknowledging the fact that part of being in the canon is the amount of time you have since a movie has been out, and time to sort of look at it in retrospect and see what a prominence it had in terms of impression on people. The what movies from the since 2000 would fall into this, and they rattle off. So I guess it looks like it's about 15 or so movies, and talk about them. And so we thought we'd quickly run through them, maybe have some reactions as to what's in there, not in there, and see what we have to say about it. So the first
thing... You also did some research, too, though, in terms of, before we even get to these films, in terms of the films that are on this list, but you also researched sort of what else was... From those particular years since the 2000s, what else was?
Yeah, well, you know, in order to try to find movies that maybe were deserving of here, being on here but not on here, I looked at the Oscar nominations for Best Picture for the since 2000, and surprisingly, there weren't a bunch of movies hanging around out there. Then I said, oh my goodness, they overlooked them. Now, mind you, a bunch of the movies, we'll quickly go through them, like I said in a moment, weren't even nominated in their years, and you know.
And if they did win, it was controversial at some level.
Right, yeah. So there's some that won that are our winners in here. So we'll run through that. But out of the movies that were not on here that were nominees, I thought the only ones I thought that maybe somebody would make an argument was Django Unchained and 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah.
And so those were two that I thought, okay, you know, maybe somebody make that argument. But it wasn't like, oh my goodness, there was a glaring omission.
It is interesting your point there. And when we start reading some of these movies... It did feel, let me say, whether or not these films are worthy of being, of sort of being the foundation for the greatest of this century is something we are going to talk about. But you're right. When I looked at the list, I'm not sitting there thinking, oh, you didn't mention such and such and such and such. Yet I do believe that when...
I know you wanted them to put Gravity on there, but it wasn't on.
Oh, well, yeah. It's not really a film, it's a cartoon. Yeah. When you review movies from the last century... Or if you sit around and have a discussion, people are going to... Everyone's... Again, we opened the show when you talked about Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, and I sat there and I said, ooh, I tend to think Rear Window's a better film. And then I mentioned three David Lean films, and they can't all make it. Yeah. So I think for the prior century, if you start talking about the greatest, you are...
Yeah, well, if you're doing default, a list for 100 years of 10...
You're going to start leaving.
But here we are, we're using 18 years, and we're going to come up with 15.
It becomes a lot easier.
It's a little bit generous, but you know, I guess it's sort of like... These are the semi-finalists or something, you know, then maybe the thought is with more time, we'll look at them. Some of them will be finalists.
To be fair, I did not agree. I have quite a few either differences of opinion or movies where I would go, yeah, I kind of get it. But, you know, something, have you ever considered this one type thing? And when we start going through this list,
it's a decent enough list. Let's go ahead and jump right into it, I think.
Sure.
It didn't appear to me that it had any order. These aren't numbered. They're not in chronological order. So I don't know exactly... She didn't say anything was the best. I think it's just a mishmash.
The author, Anne Hornaday, who I've heard on the radio a lot, she appears on Tony Kornheiser's podcast. She's been around a long time. She's written a couple of books about movies and the movie critiquing business.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get going.
Children of Men, 2006, Alfonso Cuarón. This was that movie about like a dystopian future where no children are being born anymore, so nobody has a reason to try.
Clive Owen's
the main star.
Michael Caine,
and what's her name? Redhead.
Julianne Moore.
Yeah. We both really loved it.
We went to see it together.
Yeah.
I mean, not in that way.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it, and it's you talked about the dystopian future. It is science fiction without being science fictiony, because obviously it's the future.
Yeah, it isn't like there's some future. So it's about
there are no robots.
It's almost more like I don't even know if it's science fiction because it doesn't rely on any new technology or something. It's more like
here's
the worst case scenario.
Do you count 1984 as science fiction? George Orwell's book. I guess you do, don't you?
At the time it was.
Yeah, it is. Okay. Yeah.
This is just like something weird would happen, and it had a lot of. Not only was it a pretty interesting story and unique story. It had a lot of interesting filmmaking, which is one thing I think that might be different. Like when you mentioned the 70s movies, right? They seem to me more like plays. Like they're very well written and they're plotted out very well. And certainly they're shot very well, but they aren't as hard technically to have filmed.
No. You know?
Maybe relative to what they had on their hands to do things at the time, you know, to shoot a thing a certain way might have been more difficult, but it is mostly things that we would take as conventional movie cinematography now.
I gave a brief nod to the guy that just passed away who wrote, you know, Butch Cassidy and All the President's Men. And to your point, there is this notion when you... Better written. I know movie buffs out there are going to start, you know, I can hear their ears are going to start going when we make these sort of random comments like we just did. But to your point, those films are better written. I always think that if you read those screenplays, you would sit back and go, that was an enthralling read. Just because of the fact that 25, 30 years ago, you know, that they were written in such a way that the actors could really get to grips with some of these characters. And I'm not suggesting that doesn't happen as much now, but I also think nowadays, and again, in the first comment you just made about Children of Men, it is a visually terrific film.
Right. Well, that's what I was bringing back to the fact that you know, it has this famous shot where it's a very long shot with the camera moving all the way through the building, back out of a building. A bunch of things happen without any breaks in the shooting, which is always sort of an impressive feat when somebody pulls that off, whether it's been doctored or not. It's very impressive looking. Not nominated for a Best Picture that year. I think
it was nominated for some script stuff, though.
Just Best Picture.
Which is one. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, how many things was I going to research beforehand?
No, that's
15
fair.
Minutes.
That's fair.
Next movie on there is 25th Hour, 2002, also not nominated. This was a Spike Lee urban thriller, is what they call it, with Edward Norton going to jail just before he's going to jail.
Great cast in that film.
Ed Norton, what's his name?
Philip Seymour Hoffman. Barry Pepper, a few other people. Who's the great Irish actor?
I've only seen this on TV, and it's decent possibility I've never seen the beginning. Like, it's one of those ones I stepped into. I said, oh, this is interesting. And
I love Spike. Well, it's interesting. You know, I went to the cinema to see it because I love Spike Lee movies, but I wouldn't sit here and ever say... I don't think it's his best movie. So therefore, at some moment, I am struggling. It's a great film. I think it is clearly, you know, it's very much, it was an original novel that then when he made the film, and one of the executive producers is Tobey Maguire, interesting enough, there's a bit of trivia for you. When he made the film, he decided, because he made the film a couple of years, the year after 9/11, he wedges in a lot of sort of 9/11
reference. The thing makes a lot of to-do about it, like the original set book, on the backdrop, but it's obviously...
But the original book was not, which it's based off of. Right. And so, you know, a lot of people say it's sort of Spike Lee's sort of homage to New York and, you know, 9/11 and that type of thing. But again, I don't think it's his best movie. So I do... It's a great film, but I do struggle to see it on a...
Other than the ones that I do not know at all, which were a couple, this is probably of the things I've seen and know of, I would probably be least likely for me to say, oh yeah, deserves to be up there. 2008, The Hurt Locker, Kathryn Bigelow, director.
So this was one of those, I'm sorry.
It won Best Picture, by the way.
It won Best Picture, but everyone kind of, it was up against Avatar that year.
Well, and the big thing was that she's the ex-wife of
James Cameron. But there was this sort of, The Hurt Locker, which hadn't made a lot of movie, didn't have an all-star cast. It starred Jeremy Renner, a small spoiler appearance by Guy Pearce, a small appearance from Ralph Fiennes, and then basically a lot of fresh faces at the time who are more familiar now. And it didn't make a lot of money, and it was up against Avatar, which was this sort of cutting-edge 3D blockbuster, made loads of money. And it was sort of, I think when it won, it was regarded as a bit of an upset that it won because it was a film that people hadn't really seen. I think
that might have been the first year they went with the wide set of nominations. Because so during the 2000s, they changed through 2000.
It was still five.
So five, that was last year. They had five nominees, and then they went to this like unlimited number of nominees. So, sorry.
It's a film.
Wait. 2008, yeah.
It's a really, really good film. That's so trite the way I said that. But I'm going to now say something slightly controversial.
Oh, no, it is. It did win. It won in 2009. The movies in 2008 won 2009. It was the first big slate.
Oh, okay.
So it was Avatar, Blindside, District 9, Education, Glorious Bastards, Precious, A Serious Man, Up and Up in the Air, all were nominated.
So that's a
so
big
I wonder
field.
Whether it benefited from that, you know, like that was the first
split the vote.
Because, well, you know, people were definitely complaining over the years before then that you just ended with just sort of a stock, like when Departed won in 2006, everybody's like, come on. I mean, like, fine, it's a decent movie.
Decent movie. It's not an Oscar winner, is it? Because it's not on this list,
right?
For starters. Yeah. I do struggle with
it. Crash the week.
I do struggle with The Hurt Locker's place on this list, though. I mean, you just named that year. And while I don't think Avatar should have won, there are a couple of other films that you mentioned there that I think in they will age better.
The Inglourious Basterds has got a decent case for being, you know, an interesting enough artistically movie.
And I hate to tell you something, Up is arguably the peak of those sort of cartoon films that reach a thing you always. Here's the thing with The Hurt Locker, and again, I very much enjoyed it when I saw it. The more I watch it, though, the more I sort of struggle. I don't feel there's a lot there. And you know, it's ultimately about, you know, a military man finding that he enjoys war a lot more than one is supposed to. You know, do you know what I mean? Like, he needs it in a way that was sort of counterculture to the politics of the time. Yeah, ultimately, that is a theme that has been played to death in the cinema. I mean, let's face it, Steve McQueen did it 55 years earlier in The War Lover.
I agree with you in some. My ultimate conclusion is the same as yours, but for a different reason.
Okay.
At the time, I also found it like a big deal. Like, it was very affecting at the time. I remember I was in a theater with somebody, and people were just like, oh my God, you know, yes. It was very dramatic and unusual. And Jeremy Renner was a less familiar commodity at that point.
Right.
And so it seemed more interesting. It is one where when it comes back on, I really have no. It's not like, oh boy, that thing really pioneered something new, you know, and created some sort of artistic stuff or did something unusual that I have any real interest in watching it a second time.
And I'll say this as a film is I feel like its strength is all up front and then it starts to meander and sort of just, I don't know, I don't find it a film that I really want to rewatch in its entirety. But when I catch 20 minutes of it, it holds my attention, but then I'm more than happy to check out of it. Okay. And so that's an interesting statement about that film.
All right. So because this is taking way longer than I expected, I'm gonna roll a few together.
Okay.
Because we hit our first 2007, where there are four movies on this list from 2007, three of which were nominated for Best Picture, which again was before they expanded it, and one of which I don't know anything about. So we have Michael Clayton, There Will Be Blood, a movie called 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days.
Never heard of it.
Yeah, and then No Country for Old Men. Winner for the Best Picture that year was No Country for Old Men, which is another one which I haven't actually seen front to back, which is kind of weird because you'd think it'd be normally I would think of it fitting in my area of interest.
See, I saw that in the cinema, but I've never seen There Will Be Blood in its entirety, which I find interesting.
At the best of those, and I would potentially make the case the best movie of the past 20 years is There Will Be Blood.
Well, and that's why it's interesting. And as much as I enjoyed No Country for Old Men, and I love the Coen brothers, even if we just have like a head-to-head, if you throw Michael Clayton against that,
Michael Clayton's right up there too.
I'm always going to go back and watch Michael Clayton, whereas I find No Country for Old Men is a movie I appreciate rather than enjoy. But that's an example of a packed year. For a brief moment, I thought There Will Be Blood had won an Oscar. But in fact, he won the Oscar.
Right.
But yeah, the film didn't. Actor. And that, yeah.
Being, what's his face?
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Daniel Day-Lewis, who now theoretically is retired, although seems to appear in movies.
Yeah, he appears in movies and wins an Oscar at retirement.
So, you know, I mean, of those, like Michael Clayton and There Will Be Blood are both would be in my top three or four of the past 20 years or so. So I have no trouble with them both being involved in there. Like I said, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days.
Never heard of it.
No idea. Naturalism is a cinema. I think it's like a Romanian war. Who knows? You know, I'm not even going to bother getting too involved in that. So we cover those. Then we go to back a year to Pan's Labyrinth.
I never saw that.
We saw that in the theater. And this was so Guillermo del Toro did that. And it's all this very fantasy. It's not sci-fi by any means.
Was he the one that did the one about the water and the woman falling in love with a fish? Is that him? Okay.
Yeah, but that's the kind of stuff. You know.
All right.
And when this came out, it was really quite interesting. So I'll give it credit for opening another line of cinema. Like, it's sort of taking the CGI stuff you could do, and instead of having it serve either like Lord of the Rings kind of fantasy stuff where everything's like that, or having it serve like a sci-fi plot. It's like a regular plot with a weirdness built into it, added into it kind of thing. It was a big deal. I think probably it deserves that kind of credit. I never even see it on cable to know whether I would keep watching it or not.
No, I never saw it in a cinema, and so I therefore do not run across it and do not watch any of it.
Not the worst thing I have in there. Not nominated, by the way. Boyhood, 2014, this is that movie where Gary Linklater?
Richard Linklater.
Richard Linklater, right. really literally filmed it over the course of 20 years or so, or maybe a little less, with the same actors coming back every certain number of years, so he could put it all together and, you know, focusing around this kid coming up with his parents and Patricia Arquette, who is, by the way, now in that she's in that miniseries that's coming on Netflix, I think, about, or maybe it's HBO, about the prison break that's getting these rave reviews.
Okay.
Anyway.
So did you see it?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it good?
Yeah. I thought it was really... It was...
My mom loved it, bless her.
Yeah.
I've still never seen it.
I mean, I could see... It was very... A feat of filmmaking, or a type of... That nobody... I wouldn't have occurred to somebody to try to do that. So it's very interesting artistically that way. I'm not sure if the juice is worth the squeeze on it, like that okay. effort, you know, that as a movie overall, and it's pretty interesting. It sort of stands apart from these, and it doesn't, I don't want to say it's a gimmick, because it's not, I mean, it's not a gimmick.
No, but I know what you're saying.
But it does seem sort of like, I'm not exactly sure what we'll say about that later on.
I was listening to a show on NPR yesterday, some comedy show, it's on locally in this area, it's on after... Wait, Don't Tell Me, and it's basically a pop culture, same sort of thing, but it's pop culture and trivial, and they were talking about people who had played twins in movies, and in the same way that, say, you know, Hayley Mills or Lindsay Lohan playing twins is a gimmick, the effort they make to keep going back and film these people at different times, I see what you're saying, there is a gimmicky, the hook is slightly gimmicky, and at that moment... Unlike Lindsay Lohan playing twins, yes, there's a bit more to Boyhood, but ultimately it's still the gimmick that gets you in the door.
Yeah. Got a lot of talk that way.
Yes,
It was. It was nominated, Birdman won that year.
Okay, which I saw.
Yeah, which was pretty good too. It's not a canon type movie. Next, 2006, Old Joy. Don't know anything about this movie either. It's another foreign, well, it does say American director.
Yeah, foreign movies.
But I don't know what it is. 2006? This one's 2004. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
I never saw that because I don't really like Jim Carrey.
Huh. You should see that.
Yeah.
People I think you would like it.
Yeah.
Because you like Lobster, and it's kind of love like Lobster, that weird...
Yeah. And I always think of Eternal... Spotless Mind as sort of being in there with being John Malkovich, which is a movie I admire a lot more than I enjoy. I think it was the same writer, actually.
So this is Michael Gondry off a script by Charlie Kaufman.
Kaufman, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if any what other things they do, but it is it's the Titan, Kate Winslet, and like you
mentioned,
Jim Carrey. It's also got the older guy, actually the same guy from Michael Clayton. You know, the guy who is having the mental problems in Michael Clayton.
Yes, and I can see his face, and I've forgotten his name now. But he's a wonderful actor. Tom Wilkinson,
and it has. One of the first Spider-Man, a couple other actors. It's got the guy Mark Ruffalo's in it.
Okay,
and it is sci-fi, but it's also got like a comedy element to it. It's pretty interesting.
Would you recommend it to me?
Yeah.
Okay. 100%. There you go. Like, well, that says something.
I think I guess I could make the argument if it's the can. I'd have to know more about like what we're doing here. Next, it was not nominated, by the way. Hunger, meaning for Best Picture. Hunger, 2008. Again, I don't know what that is.
Michael Fassbender.
So that's before he does 12 Years a Slave, which I mentioned was an omission here.
It's Michael Fassbender, and it's about it's based on the true events of the Irish Bobby Sands, who was an IRA terrorist who was held in British captivity in the late 70s, early 80s, and he went on a hunger strike. And it was Fassbender's big breakout role, and Fassbender lost, like, through the course of the movie, basically didn't eat because that was the only way to show the state that the guy was in. I've seen it. I find it an interesting movie in that I remember the people in it. I grew up at a time when, obviously, you know, the IRA and Bobby Sands and being in the H block, and it was in the news every day.
Maybe we're going to go back to that with Brexit.
Yeah. So I watched it, and because I had historical perspective, I enjoyed it more. I must say, as much as I like Steve McQueen's work, the new Steve McQueen, not the old Steve McQueen, who I shouted out earlier, I don't feel any need to go back and watch it. But like I said, I appreciated it for what it was.
Again, to turn your other question around, would you recommend that I watch it?
Probably, but I'd Wikipedia the whole thing first
so you have all the information.
So that you sort of know, because that's the whole point.
Have the Zeph approach.
Yes.
All right, then we go 2000, You Can Count on Me.
Which is a really enjoyable film, but I'm sorry.
Didn't see that either. Also nominated, by the way, that other movie was not nominated.
It's a great film. Matthew Broderick, Laura Linney, Mark Ruffalo again. Great film. Yeah. But I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's one of the best 20 films of this. It's a great film, not one of the best 20 films of the century so far. Oh. I'm not knocking it, but it's a good film. Yeah. But that was one of the ones I was very surprised to see it on this list. I'm like, no, come on, it's not that good. It's very good,
yeah,
but it's not. Well, and maybe what I mean when I say that is, it's not a film that's gonna. It doesn't resonate in any way beyond that was a terrific, well written hour and 50 minutes. So, for example, we've just talked about Hunger. That is notable because Michael Fassbender, the actor, puts himself through it.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, You Can Count on Me as well written. But if it had appeared on TV, you'd go, that was great, I would recommend it. But when all said and done, I'm not sitting... I feel bad putting a boot into something that's good, but I'm not... It doesn't leave a mark. There'll be some other films that come up later, and I will compare them straight because the same guy is involved in them.
All right. Actually, I was wrong about my count. There's actually another movie from 2007, I'm Not There. Which is, so now we're up to five from 2007. Apparently 2007 was the bigger.
Heck of a year, wasn't it? Yeah.
I'm Not There is, was the, I always, it, do people, it's biopic. It's not, yes. Biopic, right?
No.
Yeah. Biopic, no. Which is just kind of a weird way to say it, but it's, you know, it's about.
Biopic is when you watch it with one eye closed.
It's about Bob Dylan, yeah. Ostensibly, but it's very much an art house approach to it, where, yes. They have different actors playing him in different eras, and some of them aren't even really literal. Like the Richard Gere version of him is like, it's like a character that's sort of like a story of him, you know, where he's off in the country somewhere. It has the main one that people always talk about is Cate Blanchett, so we have a woman playing him, and that part of the story is more literal, and they kind of bounce back and forth between these different versions of him. I thought I really liked it, and, you know, I don't even like Bob Dylan that much, but you could see what they were trying to do was make a movie that was partly about him, but partly inspired by him and his way he did stories. Because okay. the whole story about Bob Dylan, when people get back into it, is that it's a little bit invented as this folk troubadour. You know, he didn't come from like the kind of backgrounds of some country person, you know, and he kind of invented this persona and wrote great songs and all, but, you know, his background is, it's somewhat of a story. So you could see how like these various plots kind of fit into that, critiquing him in all these different eras and things like that. And of course he has, you know, even people who are fans of him decided they hated him when he started playing electric guitars instead of, you know, the folk stuff that he started off with. So it's really quite interesting little feat. It does have a little bit of that Boyhood gimmick in the sense that you've got these different parts put together, and it made a bunch of people go, let me go check that out.
That's why, and that's the reason I didn't. Yeah. And it's interesting you're telling me that you enjoyed it,
yeah.
Because I just never was drawn to it, because I'm like, yeah, it was, because I'm not naturally, you know, again, my mom, bless her, loves Bob Dylan, so she went straight out to watch it, and she loves it because she loves Bob Dylan and she loves the movies. I'm not that interested in Bob Dylan, so the whole notion, its whole, you know, the hook, its conceit was not one I could buy into, so I've never seen it.
Yeah. So, and actually, this brings it all full circle. Full circle to something we were talking about beforehand and present day. It has his songs in there, but done as covers by various folks, yeah. In the course of doing the stuff, or not necessarily the main actors, but people just doing it. So there's a song called Going to Acapulco that there's somebody singing it, and when I saw it, I was like, man, that's a cool version of that song. And so I went looking it up, and the guy who was singing it was both in real life, you know, he recorded, and who they had in the movie was Jim James, who's the lead singer of My Morning Jacket, who we spoke about last week on the guitar stuff.
On a guitar show.
And last night, I just went and saw him in a solo performance. So there we go. It's right there on the page. That's where I originally found him. How about that? Here's an interesting one. 2002, Minority Report. By the way, I'm Not There, not nominated. Minority Report 2002.
Shouldn't be on the list.
Yeah, this surprised. So Philip K. Dick, so got in, you know, Steve Spielberg's adaptation of this with Tom Cruise as the main character. I don't really understand why they would say that this is such a big deal.
I think because it's Steven Spielberg doing Philip K. Dick, and I think that's why. I'm going to say something about this film, and I'm going to say something about
I thought to myself when I was, and I can't remember the movie, I thought there was another Tom Cruise movie after this that I thought, well, that would be, you know, if you're going to say there was some big deal movie from the 2000s with him, but now I can't remember what it was.
But Minority Report is a great, it's a very entertaining film, and the only reason it's here on this list is because it's directed by Steven Spielberg.
But I felt like they had to put one in
for and I do feel a little bit, because even, and I'm not, this is now, again, I'm going to sound like I'm criticizing, and I don't mean to. If you asked me, if you said to me, name the four greatest Steven Spielberg movies, this wouldn't come anywhere near the conversation.
Yeah.
And here's the interesting thing now, and I'm not suggesting, yes, obviously he has made many great films, but in a strange way, you know, I would...
I know what I was just thinking. It was The Edge of Tomorrow. It's that movie where, like, you know, that they're now starting to run on cable again, so it goes through a cycle. That's the one where he's like, you know, live,
it keeps dying.
Die, repeat. That was definitely a better and more interesting... I don't know. That was not a canon movie, but that was certainly a more... If I had to pick a movie that was in this sci-fi, that was a much more interesting artistic achievement than The Minority Report.
Yeah, and I think allegorically it does a bit more than Minority Report either.
Yeah.
But again, it's very serviceable Steven Spielberg, which ultimately in a strange way is a super high bar, but it is still serviceable Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
It ain't the best film he's done in the last 20 years, so it shouldn't be on this
list. Yeah, that one's out of place.
Which then leads to the next one on the list, which I actually think probably should be there.
Yeah, you're too biased.
Just if it gets in there. Because I do think...
Because I've been announcing them all, I'm not going to hide the ball. Dunkirk 2017, we all know that Zeff's like favorite movie of the past bunch of years. I certainly enjoyed it.
So I'm going to make the case for it now. If Steven Spielberg's Minority Report makes it a lot because it's Spielberg...
But you can't, the movie that said isn't on there, you can't be like, well, if this makes it...
I'm just going to compare apples. I'm going apples
to
apples.
I'm not saying it shouldn't be on list, by the way.
Children of Men is a terrific feat of movie making. I think Dunkirk gets on this list because of that. I'm not saying, you know, in 5 years this movie might not appear on the list, but right now I'm gonna go, yep, the guy did something with the way he told the story that works. So anyway, it's there. It's got more of it to me in a head-to-head thing. If there's only one seat in the lifeboat, well, I'm keeping Dunkirk over Minority Report. And Minority Report is a great movie by a great director. That's all I'm saying.
The timeline piece of Dunkirk, which by now, hopefully, whoever's seen it has seen it. But if you haven't, there's different plot lines in it. And because of the nature of what they're covering, they do them on different timelines. And it's a little bit unclear. It seems to me it's interesting, but it's not that important part of it. Like, once you know that, you're like, oh, now I know that. Okay, fine. That's what the timeline is. It's not like, oh, my goodness, that's an artistic achievement.
Yeah, I'm going to
give
you that.
I think cinematography of it is much more interesting the way they shoot it.
Okay.
That's much more interesting. But I agree. Like, when it's on TV, like, I know you own it, but I don't really feel that compelled to watch it.
Oh, no, I do.
But
I always get dragged into it.
Yeah.
I think because of the way that it's filmed and directed.
I know everything that's going to happen. And
yeah. All right, so moving along.
Mudbound 2017 also.
Never heard of it?
I've heard of it. It was a streaming one primarily, and then they released a little bit.
Yeah.
I have it on my list to see. I have not seen it yet. Spotlight 2015, that won the best picture. By the way, Dunkirk year, this is when Shape of Water won best picture, and it was nominated but did not win. So Spotlight is another one that's just on my list. I just haven't gotten around to watching it yet.
That's a really good film.
Everybody says great things about it.
And Spotlight's a good film, and it's an important film in the way that All the President's Men is a good film and an important film, and not just because they are about journalists breaking a story. But here's the interesting thing. So when I talked about You Can Count on Me, which is also set in New England and has Mark Ruffalo in it, Mark Ruffalo is in Spotlight as well.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting when you think about actors who recur through a number of these movies.
So I'm not going to compare these two films.
Which doesn't necessarily mean that's about them being in a good movie. It's just about, like, maybe people who make good movies cast them for things.
Spotlight is telling an important piece of social history, documentary message. So therefore, it finds its way onto the list. You Can Count on Me is just as well written. They are very similar the way they are filmed. They're understated. There are great performances. But at the end of the day, You Can Count on Me is a domestic drama, but it doesn't resonate in terms of its importance as Spotlight. So therefore, if there's one seat left on the boat, Spotlight gets it. And I know it's a comparison that we are forcing, but I'm just trying to make my point about You Can Count on Me being a great film, but ultimately that is all it is.
All right. Son of Saul. 2015, not nominated. I do not know what this is.
No,
you?
No.
Something, it's a pretty long bio. Something about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
but it doesn't even really talk about who made it. Filmed in squared-off aspect ratio that accentuated the protagonist's entrapment, Nimes, I guess that's the director.
Yeah.
Anyway. Stories We Tell, 2012, also not nominated, don't know what that is either. In the personal memoir of her own childhood, actress and child, Sarah Paul. Oh, it's like a personal memoir type of
thing. Yeah, I heard it was quite good. It was notable. Sarah Polley had directed, she also directed another film around that.
See, this came out long enough that I wonder, like, they would put Lady Bird on this now, maybe.
Yeah.
Not that I've seen that either. Fog of War, I've not seen that, 2003. I've seen that,
and I'm going to tell you something right now. If it's about Vietnam, well, it's about Robert McNamara.
It's a documentary.
It's a documentary.
But it's supposed to be an interestingly done documentary.
It's brilliant. Okay. I never thought I would like it. Someone else had it and they put it on and I was going to sort of read the paper and ignore it. And then after 2 minutes, I was all the way in.
In the 1990s, Errol Morris revolutionaries the documentary filmmaking with his use of narrative film technique. Then he does it with this one. So ultimate example of an otherwise derided nonfiction form, the talking head movie.
And that's what it is. It is very much a guy talks to the camera to tell you about. Now, obviously, it is momentous because of the time of history and what it talks about. It talks about Vietnam. It talks about the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. But you know, something... for that reason, it's on the list, and for that reason, it's worth watching. It's really, really good.
Right. Not nominated, also. I'm sure it was nominated for documentary category. Royal Tenenbaums, 2001, also not nominated. Wes Anderson, you know, anybody who sort of knows anything about Wes Anderson knows his particular style. Cast a lot of this. Bill Murray's in all these movies all the time, maybe, and a lot of quirky kind of activity. This one's got both of the Owen brothers and Gwyneth Paltrow.
Gene Hackman.
I quite like this movie, and this is a movie I will watch. I was about to say this, but basically the little quote in the article here is avoiding quirk for quirk's sake. It's quirky, but it's not like totally just being weird to be weird. It is a plot, you know, it has a story to it. You know, it's not a, it's what's the Steve Zissou, you know, with the underscore of Steve Zissou.
Which I like more.
Well, it's more fun. This is less fun and more of like a real movie.
Well, here's the thing, and I love
this. I mean, I like the fabulous, fantastic Mr. Fox, most of all of those, and yeah, that's definitely just for fun.
I love all Wes Anderson movies.
I never saw the Dogs one. Did you see the Dogs one?
No, I'm waiting to watch that.
Okay.
My stepdaughters want to watch it, so we will watch it together.
Mm. Maybe do it over the holidays. I'll come on by and we can watch
it. Yeah, we can watch it again. I might buy it like I did Dunkirk. Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's great. I loved it. I watched it in the cinema. But again, my personal bias says it's not my favorite Wes Anderson movie, so I struggle to see it here on the list. So, but that is a personal bias, not some sort of cinematic judgment that I'm trying to
make. I think it's fair to put it on the list as a representative sample of stuff. Last one, Stripped Away, is just an animated Japanese anime movie. We, of course, didn't see it, 2001, and it was not nominated, so we won't talk about it at all.
All right, so basically, if you don't agree with some of those selections, don't email us. Tweet Anne Hornaday from the Washington
Post. Maybe that gives you some idea, especially heading into the holidays. If you're listening to this, you know, you're looking for something with those family to do, and you're like, oh man, now what the problem with these things is finding them. Like, is it on Amazon? Is it on Netflix? Can I get on a pay-per-view on my cable system? What is it? You know, but I think you could find these movies somewhere. And if there's some that you have thought of or this reminds you, go ahead and go watch it and let us know if you found it worthwhile.
To your point, and I will actually try and find the original article and stick it in the link. It is worth, you can't go wrong, even though I've been ambivalent about some of those films, and between us, you and I hadn't watched about a quarter of them, you can't go wrong if you just close your eyes and drop your finger on the newspaper and it lands on one of those films.
That's right. If nothing else, it's true to learn about the filming and see, okay, you know, your opinion could be, it isn't deserved there, but that it'll be worth the time. You won't be encountering bombs amongst them.
Exactly. So, two men, we will now switch to the second half of the show. Yeah. Two men who, I don't know how much we know about film, but we know how much we like to predict what we know about film.
Yeah.
Let us get to this, the 20, I don't have the bell, I need to get the bell. Let me get the bell out while you set up the 2018 roundup.
2018 roundup, so what we did beforehand, as people apologize for those of you who already know what this is we would, on each movie based on the previews and trailers we would see, because of course we couldn't see the movies in advance, we don't get advanced screeners here yet, we would predict whether it would be a critical and financial basically two categories. So every movie has 2 points available, which you would say critically or financially successful. Financially successful for our book basically is making as much money domestically in the United States as your budget was. Problem is, if you basically go global budget, almost everybody seems to make money. Critically is based on Rotten Tomatoes being fresh. Rotten Tomatoes, I think over the course of this summer or whatever, changed its formula for tabulating. I don't know that it had any impact on things, was one or two here. You've compiled the results. I'm always a little suspicious when Zeph compiles the results, and I have my own notes to go back to. I may have to pull up a couple of these because there's one or two movies that have very high reviews, which I'm not saying they were badly reviewed, but they seem inordinately high based on what you've got here, and so I always have a little question as
that's
whether
fine. You know, that's fine. We can go.
I have a tab open for Box Office Mojo, which has a lot of the stats. It's harder and harder to get the financial stats on movies these days. I don't know why that is, but
we talked about that though. We talked about that back in the summer preview. You can go back in the blog and find it. That studios were far more reticent to release that figure because we talked at the time about you don't want to negatively set the narrative that this movie cost all this money and it's not making that money,
right?
So by extension, it must suck.
That's true. I should say, when I say financial information, you can get the box office, fine. Yes. What you can't get is like the stats on what it actually cost them to make these movies.
All right, so let's get going with the roundup. We do it like golf. So
what's crazy about it is some of these movies I don't even remember friggin' existing here. So the first one we had was Adrift, which was this caught at sea movie. We don't need to get into Shailene Woodley and somebody else, I think, wasn't that who was in it. I had predicted it would be both a critical and financial success, and you said the same thing. By the way, a lot of these things we can just do it like a match play type of thing where it's only whether people get an advantage or not. Since we both predicted the exact same thing, there's no loss to anything. We were right on critical, 73%.
Movie didn't make much money at all. It was cheap to make, but it didn't make a lot domestically. It made 31 off a $35 million budget, so that was that one. Let's move along to the first big blockbuster of the summer, which was Deadpool. And by the way, Movie Richard, who has a show on our blog, he's watched most of these, and as always, I've asked him to give us his comments because I'm very upfront in saying I didn't see anything this summer, so therefore I can't personally tell you how good any of these films were. Deadpool, he really liked a lot. He thought Josh Brolin was incredible. We both said, well, actually, my partner didn't make a prediction.
Well, you know, this was, I was trying to figure out, what does that mean here? I mean,
well, what it means is you've liked
the blank. I think this movie was so early, it was technically before, and you went ahead and made a prediction. It wasn't really on our list, so I don't know if you really get points for it. Because it's not like I would have not, what was I going to forego 2 points automatically?
Okay.
Let me just look at my notes, though, because.
No, I'm looking at my notes from May. I'm looking at the actual piece of paper
when
that we
that
wrote
released?
On. I don't know, May. And there is a blank next to your name, or under your name next to this movie. I have written double up under my column. So therefore, you did not make a prediction.
No, I've got it written. It's right here.
What did
I have
you
it
say
double
then?
Up.
Oh, okay. Then my note taking just might be an error on this one.
Yeah,
movie.
That's what I think. All right.
Just on this
nonetheless,
one
nonetheless, it's a 0-0 anyhow.
All right,
that way, because
Deadpool.
We both predicted it. And that it did make, by the way, you have to come back to this, it made 318.
On 110 budget.
On 110. It was like
huge.
Well, we're going to come to like superlatives at the end of the thing, and it was a candidate on at least mine.
All right, so the next movie we're going to talk about is Solo, and I went back into the archives, and we're now going to play a 2.5-minute clip of my partner and I talking about Solo and making our predictions in 2016.
Right, to clarify, this is not the prediction at the beginning of the summer.
We'll come back to that question then.
This is the prediction from like when they first announced the movie was going to come out.
Okay, in the spirit of our summer movie previews that are coming out in our next episodes, I'm now going to rank the Han Solo movie, and I'm going to tell you why. This movie is going to be a double bomb. It's going to not make any money. Let me finish.
Oh, go ahead.
It's not going to make a lot of money. It's going to be critically hammered, and let me tell you why. As I ring the bell, because that will repeat. Nick, I went all the way to the back to get the bell. Just
listen.
I came strong.
We're going to write this one down because.
Write it down.
I'm going to make some money.
I'm predicting 3 years out. That's brave.
2 years.
Whatever.
First of all, everything you say there in terms of describing the way people may react
is true.
Might be right.
Thank you very much.
That's all I need to hear. Your central thesis, however, that this will be a double bomb. Could not be more wrong. I will throw $1,000 wager that it won't be a double bomb.
It's not about the money.
So here's what I'm saying. First of all, it's certainly possible that, well, I should say, back up. What they have shown us so far with this
new franchise and the way Disney's
it's been terrific. I'm not knocking it. Yes,
engineered.
Yes, like terrific.
You know, not good, maybe it's not going to win Oscars, but it is engineered very good. To please.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
So this movie comes up 2 years from now. I have no doubt that people will say, you know, they might even say not quite up to the level because we've got all this baggage and stuff like that. But I assure you that this is not going to get a full negative review. It won't be a bad movie. It will be maybe not a great movie, maybe not as good as up to the ones that they've been doing recently.
Sure.
There's no chance it's going to get bad. Like you know, we're talking about bomb reviews. Bomb reviews are 20% Rotten Tomatoes kind of things.
Actually, the marker is 60%, and it has to fall below 60%.
In any event, it won't be that bad. And also, the notion that this is not going to make money is insane. It doesn't. There's no chance that people, all the Star Wars fans, when presented with at least the opportunity to see a prequel Han Solo, are going to be like, nah, never mind, not going to bother going at all. They're all going to go. They might all go just to put the boot in, but they're going to go.
Okay, Well, we'll make bombs critically. We'll make money. That's my prediction. This is an interesting thing, though. We'll see. I'm making my prediction.
Underestimating movies.
The 2016 summer movie preview is coming out shortly.
Yeah,
but this prediction is for the 2018 summer movie preview. So there you go. Harrison Ford movie. Han Solo movie. Some guy we've never heard of.
All right.
So it's interesting.
I feel, you know, I listened to that in advance and I didn't realize this was 2 years ago and I was feeling pretty bad, but now I don't feel as bad now that I listened to it.
I should actually lose a point. I'm going to give you a point here because I changed my prediction from double bomb in 2016 to double up.
I know.
And yet even...
Which is weird because in the lead up to this, like I would not have made that same prediction because in the lead up to this movie being released, there was a lot of talk about problems with this movie.
Yeah.
And the fact that we both ultimately said it was going to be financially and critically successful... it's kind of shocking to me because, frankly, I was raving about the possibilities then, but I wasn't totally sold on it. And you were like saying it was genuinely could be bad. And yet with more bad news, maybe it was because we had intervening between them. We had all the money that was made by the other Star Wars movies like Rogue, because this would have been before Rogue One, I think. When we made the prediction early 2016.
Yes, that's correct.
So probably that convinced us, hey, there's like almost like they couldn't do any wrong.
I'm going to give you the whole, and I'm going to tell you why.
Right.
I'm going to tell you why, because you made the prediction that it, you, as I think you said that, it's not going to get bad reviews.
No, I got the review part right
on.
You got the
review part right on. Because it comes in at 70%, which is not impressive. It's not bad.
Right.
It's not, it doesn't flow, it's not a green splat, but it is a red tomato. But most movies, they're looking for 85% and above. I think Rogue One ended up at 89%.
Yeah.
The Last Star Wars a bit lower than that. So it was lower. But I found it more interesting that it didn't make back its domestic budget. And that's what surprised me.
Well, you know, so the box office stats, when they give us, is that global?
I had to search a couple of websites. So this is not me playing with the numbers. The number I found for US was 213 against the budget of 275.
I have the 213 here in Box Office Mojo, but I always thought that Box Office Mojo was global stats. So maybe
they break it down. Okay. And so that's what I found interesting.
It made money. I'm sure, if you added in the global stuff, it made money.
It's done fine.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, but it wasn't like it went. It wasn't like a bust, like you know, these movies where people talk about losing hundreds of thousand dollars or something like that. But it definitely was not what they expected. And in fact, I mean, we could spend a whole episode talking about where Disney is going with this. In fact, we do have. Maybe we'll save that stuff. But the short version is that Disney has really materially changed its plans going forward on dealing with Star Wars. In part, I think because of what happened with this movie.
Solo will end up being very important towards the life of that franchise because of its performance.
Yeah, where they're going to do it and what they're
going to
do.
So I'm going to give you the whole. We both predicted double up. We would have been wrong under normal circumstances.
I'm going to put it here just in case I need it.
Put it in your back pocket.
Because in terms of our actual predictions, it was a matchup.
It was a tie, okay.
Yeah. Action Point.
The Johnny Knoxville film. We both said it was a double bomb. Double bomb.
Yeah.
Ocean's 8, which I thought was an interesting film. We had a lot of discussion about Ocean's 8. I thought the whole idea was past it, but I thought because of who was in it, it would get critical good reviews and it would bomb financially. You said it was a double up. You are correct. It's double up. That being said... it's reviews.
It was considerably less than expected. Let's put it that way.
How well reviewed it was, or how much money?
Both. Okay. Really. I mean, because I think people thought pretty highly of where this was going to go. It was, you know, 67%. So it was slightly less than the Star Wars thing, but and made $139 million on a 70. So it's doubling its budget. I mean, that's nothing to sneeze at. It's kind of amazing that it had a 70 million budget with that number of names. But maybe it's just goes to go with gender bias.
Yeah,
or something.
It got 67% on Rotten Tomatoes. But it was interesting. I expected it to be a critical darling, and it wasn't. And that surprised me more. That surprised me more than me getting the financial numbers wrong. That's what I find interesting. It was, like I say, it doubled its budget in the U.S. But I'm more surprised at the fact that it wasn't at 85% on Rotten Tomatoes or 90%. I expected critics to think it was great.
Yeah.
And at 67%, there are some critics who thought it was great, but there are quite a few who put the boot in.
By the way, just for movies that we won't be talking about, but Widows, which is out now, is or just about to come out.
I think it came out this week.
So this is like another crime thing with women, movie. And it's people have said fantastic things about this movie. It's much more like darker, and it's not like an Ocean's 8 caper type of thing.
No, it's a thriller.
But people said great things. So if you wanted to have a good version of women committing crimes, this might be it.
Based on an 80s British TV series.
All right, then.
Yeah. So there you go. So anyway, you win that hole because you did correctly. Double up, and it was double up.
It's, you know, it's technically a plus. Like, if I got two things, I only got one because you did say critical success. So it's not like you were. So it's only a plus one there for me. Hotel Artemis, which I'm trying to remember, is this the one with
Jodie Foster?
Okay.
All kinds of dudes in it.
First, so I said critical failure, financial success. You said double bomb. Its budget. Is this really true? Was $12 million?
I mean, that was a number I could find, but in a strange way, it doesn't matter because its box office was only six.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can't believe a movie was made for $12 million, but you know something? It didn't even make that back.
Right. I saw enough ads for it that I would have thought it at least made $12 million.
Yeah.
But no, it did not. Made $7 million. So, you are... Because it was critical failure, just under 60%.
I win the hole.
So you get a plus one there. All right.
Next. What's the running total? We're still tied, right? We're still tied, even though that Solo thing is sitting there to be determined later.
Taking the 2016 Solo out of the picture, we're tied.
Yes. All right. So let's move along. Tag, which was the Jeremy Renner dude from Matt, John, what's his, John Hamm.
Yeah.
What's his name? Who was on The Office?
Ed Helms.
It was the comedy, and we sort of went back and forth on it. And
it looked funny.
Yeah.
Apparently, the critics didn't think it was funny. Now, not a super duper bomb, but 54%, so under the 60% qualifies as a bomb. Made twice its budget, basically back in money.
Yeah.
I had said it would be double success. You had said it'd be a critical success, but a financial failure.
So I'm wrong. You
completely
get a point.
The opposite. But one of mine was wrong. So I get a plus one there.
You get a plus one.
Jurassic World. It's not much. There's no money to be made here between the two of us because we both said it would be critical and financially successful. We didn't necessarily think it was great. It was not critically successful. Only 51%.
And that's interesting.
Yeah.
It got pounded.
Yeah, I didn't see it, did you?
No, I didn't. No. And I saw the first of the new series, and I enjoyed it a lot for what it was. We talked at the time about this sort of nostalgia and everything that went with it, and I really enjoyed watching that one in the cinema. It is one of those films that when it comes on TV, depending where I am, I'm probably not going to watch it.
Yeah.
So therefore, at that moment, I had very little interest in the sequel, in the same way that I had very little interest in the original Jurassic Park sequel, The Lost World. I was surprised, though, the critics not were so harsh on it.
Well, because, I mean, from what I remember of the reviews, and we didn't see it, so we can't say, was essentially it was, like, abandoned the dinosaurs for, like, a plot about, like, corporate takeovers and things like that. And they went to the mainland, and I gather there was just not as much cool sort of self-contained dealing with dinosaurs kind of adventure like all these movies had before. Somebody really took it a somewhat different direction.
Which now says that I am now going to claim to be more sophisticated than A, the critics, and B, the audience. I remember saying when we talked about the first Jurassic, of the new set of Jurassic World,
I remember saying, well, where do you take this further? Because at the end of the day, it's a dinosaur movie. And at the end of the day, dinosaurs run around and eat people. Mm-hmm. Well, lo and behold, at the next sequel, the director and the writers attempted to do that. They failed critically, but they made a bag of money because you can roll a dinosaur out of anything and you're going to make money. I mean, it made a lot of money. 416 on 170. So I think, therefore, I'd have to do the math to see if it's actually a bigger earner than Deadpool against budget. No, it's not. It's less of a, because it cost 170, whereas Deadpool only cost 110. So it's less financially successful than Deadpool, although that is on a sliding scale where, you know, when you're talking about billions of dollars, Jurassic World, the sequel, made it. But again, it got hammered. It got hammered critically, which kind of surprised me. So we split that hole because we all said it was sort of bulletproof.
Yep. Sicario, this is, well, that's their full name is what, Day of the Soldado.
Actually, it's Day of the Soldado.
Oh, is that right?
That's how you say
that's,
it.
Yeah. I don't know what accent that is. I don't think that's a Mexican
Day
accent.
Of the Soldado.
That's sort of like Asian. Wouldn't it? That's like you're doing a Japanese or Chinese accent?
People confuse me for people. I have some Asian in me. People call me Hispanic all the time. So there you go.
So this one, I was looking because I had, according to your notes, I said critical and financial failure.
Yep.
And you had said critical success, financial failure. It was critical success, borderline 64%. Financially, it was success. 50. Why did I think it wouldn't be a financial success?
I don't know, but I'm looking at my original notes, and it has. I always use icons, so arrows. You have C with an arrow pointing down, and F with an arrow pointing down.
Yeah,
so
no, I'm looking at my notes. It's
well,
right.
There you go.
It's usually your stuff that confuses. No, I think I finally dissuaded you from your multiple.
Permutations. I hate to say this. It sounds like you're searching for a controversy where it doesn't exist. At the end of the day, I won the whole.
I'm frustrated with myself.
Oh, yeah, but I won the whole. So there you
all
go.
All right. Whoops, wait a minute. I marked the wrong place there.
Yeah, here you go. You see,
Ant-Man, which was Ant-Man and the Wasp, which I did finally see on a plane on the way back from the West Coast recently, and that we said critical and financial success. Each of us, it was in fact a critical and financial success, and a pretty decent one at that. Financial's not huge, but 88% positive review, $216 million on an uncertain budget somewhere in the upper 100s. This is a now an established part of the Marvel Universe approach where they're going to have some of these movies that are not the super-duper Infinity War is battling against everything under the sun, but rather right. self-contained, tighter plots. And I think it's a good move by them, and it was a success. And I enjoyed the movie, too.
I want to give Richard a shout-out. You can find his show on our blog under Movie Richard's Movie Month. He says he hates Ant-Man, but he really enjoyed this, and Paul Rudd is money. So I think that speaks a little bit, and so I want to make a point.
If he really enjoyed this, and Paul Rudd is money, how could he say he hates Ant-Man? Or does he mean he hates the character?
Yeah, I think he hates the character, because he doesn't. He's sort of Marvel most of the way, but not all of the way. So therefore, he's like, well, I don't really get it with this character, which I think is true for a lot of the people who are ambivalent about comic book characters. They just don't resonate with the character. I mean, I get Batman, but I don't have a lot of time for Superman. And so what I'm saying is, I think what Ant-Man is successfully doing is it's actually able to reach that audience. It shows it because it made a whole bag of money. All right, so Dwayne Johnson, the myth of Dwayne Johnson Hollywood Viagra, I mean, it's got to go. His movie Skyscraper, I said it was going to be a double bomb. You said it would be critically hammered, but it would still make money. It had 48% on Rotten Tomatoes. It made $67 million on its $125 million budget. In America, that's a bomb.
Yeah.
People are getting fired over that.
Yeah, I probably should have thought of this. This is a movie genre that seems to be stuck. Like this sort of old school, big budget, you know, heir to Die Hard, blow up stuff, run around, do things, you know, like with action heroes. It doesn't seem to be working now.
You know why it doesn't work? I'm going to make this statement. It doesn't work because you can watch TV and watch the original Die Hards and they don't feel of their time. If you watch the original Die Hard, it's 1988. That movie is 30 years old, but it doesn't feel like a 30-year-old movie.
The stunts are real. The lines are snappy. Again, those old diehards are much better than the new diehards, which says how good those old diehards are. So therefore, Dwayne Johnson doing a diehard knockoff, what do I need to see that for? I can watch Die Hard on cable again, and it's just as good.
Yeah. Well, and of course, the skyscraper stunts are like totally not possible, whereas at least you watch Die Hard, you're like, oh, that could actually happen.
Yeah, I mean, I still think Die Hard and at least the first two Lethal Weapons are still great films. You know, and many of those
plus are. Plus, it was educational. Taught you what a bearer bond was.
There you go, yes.
So you picked up a point there because, for whatever reason, I thought it'd make money. I'm never going to say that anymore.
This is the year when I believe that double bombing you to death might get me to win.
Well, this was always the success, was that almost everything seemed to make money before.
Not now.
And now nobody's making any money.
Because I love jumping on a loop.
It must be the budgets have gotten bigger.
Mission Impossible.
Mission Impossible, which I just, I'm, this growing, like, esteem for the Mission Impossible series, you know, where, oh, by the way, I meant to mention this, Dwayne Rock, like, somebody, I just was reading something, I think Drew Magri had some write-in where people were like, dude, this guy hasn't really actually been in a good movie for a very long time now. And so, like, talking about this stuff, you know, the best movie he's got is that Jumanji sequel, which is actually quite entertaining.
Oh, it is?
Back to Mission Impossible, like, whatever, they're all deciding it's a big deal. It got a glowing, I mean, this 97, this is the one I wanted to look up. I don't understand how he could get in that. I can accept a success, you know, like a good review. But what is it? It's Fallout, right? Is the I'm going to look it up. But well, I've got just to make sure we've got gotten cooked.
I've got a theory about this, and I just want to shout out again, Movie Richard, who said it was one of the best films of the year. No flaws. Henry Cavill was awesome, and I hope they make many more. So, I do think there is this sort of nostalgic / retroactive affection for the Mission Impossible series. Yes. After 2 and 3, I never thought 1 was that great. I was slightly underwhelmed by it, although I appreciate it more now when I see it on TV. I did think the one before this was very good, Ghost Protocol, I think that was. Mm-hmm. But I think there is also part of this sort of, you know, the media are ready to fall back in love with Tom Cruise as he's aging. And so, right, yeah, like, isn't it great that a 50-year-old man is throwing himself about? And wow, isn't it amazing? And Tom Cruise this and Tom Cruise that. And I'm not being critical of Tom Cruise and his force of will and force of personality, but I think Tom Cruise has had a lot of movies that didn't get the kind of affection that maybe they deserved. There was that other one that the year after he made Edge of Tomorrow, he made that sci-fi one that people sort of dismissed. I can't remember what it was called now.
You mean the one where he's like a replicant of himself? Yes. And he's on the planet. Yeah.
And yet, when he does Mission Impossible, you know, these are crowd pleasers. These are not John le Carré spy thrillers. And I think because no one else is making these sort of films, like Bonds appear once every 4 years at the moment, or 5 years, or 6 years, until who knows when the next one's coming out, the James Bond one, I think another 2 years. So if you don't like comic book films, there's not a lot left for you. So Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible shows up, and it gives the slightly older audience a reason to come to the cinema. The critics all tend to be slightly older, so they go all in and go, this movie's brilliant. At the end of the day, it's a stunt festival. The stunts are great, but there are loads of movies where the stunts are great. And I'm just trying to create a theory as for why people go, 97%, because the critics...
But you're talking about, I guess. I mean, it didn't actually make that much money.
I'm not saying they're right. I'm just trying to explain.
It didn't make that much money. It made $220 on a $178 budget.
No, it did, surprisingly.
But at 97%, so maybe it's going to be done. I was just thinking myself, well, I just made this case that, like, the Die Hard movies are dead type movies. And, like, here we have this movie. But I guess the difference is it's that international element to it where it's all, like, it's almost like the self-contained action adventure.
Well, no, but I also want to say this too about the Mission Impossible films.
Did you want to say this?
Sorry, the Mission, let me say this. The Mission Impossible films, the last couple have all been PG-13. So, like, again, there's something very family-friendly around them. When you watch the original Die Hard, where there's an F-bomb being dropped every 7 seconds and people getting gunned down and blood going everywhere, you know, compared to Mission Impossible, those movies are ass. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I just think there's something sort of, hey, it's fun, family, Tom Cruise is great, and it's kind of exciting. I don't know. Like I say, I'm just trying to explain why the critics almost give it a free pass. Because you know something? if it's one of the highest ranked movies of the year, well, yeah, up for an Oscar. It's not art. Come on now. But you're right. I think people give it a free pass. Whereas when on the next movie,
Mile 22, Mark Wahlberg.
Oh, I win that hole, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
Sorry. The next movie, so this is Mark Wahlberg trying to do action, adventure, die-hardish type stuff. Mile 22.
I must not have done my research very well.
This movie tanked.
25% and then like half it's, well, a little more than half.
36 on 50 million.
Yeah.
36 million.
So you double bombed it. Yeah. I set it two up. I have no idea why I would have thought it would be reviewed well. Like, I could see the financial, but reviewed well? I don't know where it's.
I don't know why I said that.
Was that one of the drinking episodes?
Maybe. If actually, I don't get. You use what I get.
Anyway, you're plus two on this one.
Yeah, because this is my year.
Yeah, I'm looking ahead, and you're going to roll through this stuff.
Can we stop for a moment here?
Yeah. I'm trying to draw this thing.
No. There is a part of me that enjoys the fact that we could do this podcast for 20 years and I would be something and one. But in a strange way, now that I look like I'm finally going to win a summer, I want to enjoy every second.
Yeah, I bet. All right. That didn't go well. So after that, Spy Who Dumped Me, which looked pretty promising to me on paper.
This is a surprise.
This was Mila Kunis and Kate McKinnon, action-adventure comedy with spies, best friend. I mean, it seemed like a lot like the spy movie with
Melissa McCarthy.
Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock, which did well and was well-received. I said critical financial success. You said double bomb. And it was, in fact, a double bomb.
But I do want to make a comment. You and I have always agreed that comedies are somewhere to look. If you're playing the game like we do, comedies are somewhere to look for value because their budgets tend to be lower. And it only made $33 million on 40.
Yeah,
ironically, you know, 40 is still at the low end. You know, Dwayne Johnson's Skyscraper made 67 on 125. Like, that movie tanked. And then you're looking at some of these other, you know, budgets. Ant-Man, over 150. Mission Impossible, 178. You know, again, Skyscraper, 125. Jurassic World, 170. 40 million for a summer movie ain't that much money. And so I'm surprised it didn't make its money back.
Yeah.
It's a comedy, came out in the summer. You're sitting there going, I'm done watching people shoot each other. The Mark Wahlberg movie is terrible. Let me go and watch the comedy. And yet people didn't do that.
Yeah. Plus two on that for you. Happy Time Murders, this is one of those ones where you, like, when you looked at things ahead of time and you do it off of previews and it's a movie on the back end of the summer, you wish you had the information, you know, sooner. So
you were convinced that
I still want to go see it because it doesn't make any sense. Hit. So, you know, like, but listen, you love the Ted movie, right? You know,
yeah,
like,
I did, yeah.
You know, Isn't this more interesting?
And,
you know,
I said I thought it would be critically well reviewed.
By the way, for people who don't know, because it came and went very quickly, it was a mixture of live action and puppets, like Muppet type puppets, and they're like doing crime. It's like a world where the things were mixed together.
Yeah,
kind of a cool, funny, weirdo premise.
Yeah,
you know?
So it's
just like the play that's been running on
Avenue Q
Broadway forever.
Yeah. And you mentioned Ted, which was like a teddy bear that swore and acted like a person, and that made a bag of cash. To your point, yeah, this thing, I mean, there's a reason this movie got made. People said, look, here's the track record for this stuff. I think we've got a winner here. And yet, it was not a winner by any extent.
At least on this one, you didn't pick up 2 points. I mean, because you also said it would be a critical success. It was a 22%. I think this is the lowest reviewed of the movies that we have on this list here.
Yep.
So I'm going to pick up one here.
Okay.
So, you know, not yet skunked. The Meg, which was that movie about the gargantuan shark with Jason Statham, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know what your thing says here.
Like, I couldn't have been more wrong on this movie.
Right. You said critical success, financial failure. I have in
you
my
said
notes
the
right
same
here.
Thing.
You're my no. So hold on a second.
Oh, you have critical no. So that's correct.
My notes here.
Yeah.
Say insane under your prediction because it didn't make any sense to me then. The idea that, like, this big shark movie was going to be critically well reviewed but not make money, because if the shark movie was critically well reviewed, it would make money. But there's just no way you could get that combination. And so you've got both of those wrong because, oddly enough,
it did make money, but only
just made money 45% in the review, so it's critically unsuccessful. Now, I said critical failure.
And then you didn't have anything else.
I have financial down, but I have a note underneath that says I can't tell. I think you might have convinced me to switch to financial up.
This is great that you can't read your own handwriting.
Well, you're the one who listened to it back. What did it say?
You hammer me about my handwriting and how all my notes have no integrity because we can't read your writing in May, so how can we trust your writing in November? You can't read your own writing. You've said there that you said it would make money. It did make no. It wouldn't make money.
Well, I said no, but I think what this says is borderline said financial up.
All right, but
but I can't.
But you get a point because it did make money.
Well, yeah, I would actually get 2 points if I did that off of this because I was both saying it was critically failure.
Don't take 2 points. Okay.
I know. That's the 2 points. Just close the gap a little bit.
That's fine. Yeah.
But I have a feeling what happened in this in the course of discussing, I got persuaded of one thing or the other. So, all right, I'm taking my 2 points there.
Take your 2 points.
So, it doesn't matter because you win.
I've thumped you, haven't I? We had to wait 7 years for a win in this thing, and I've batted you. And I'll give you your Han Solo point as well.
Okay.
Take your Han Solo point
one,
from 2016.
Two, three, 5 points up on me. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 9 points up on you. So, you go +4 on me.
Do you know what I am? Even though I'm now American as well, I'm Europe in the Ryder Cup. I'm just destroying them.
No,
just
maybe this is what made you better is that your American citizenship.
Yes.
Now the last thing we talked about in this was what would be the biggest movie of the summer, and you said Deadpool number one, Jurassic number two, and then I have a little note on here on Solo. I think we basically had like sort of these backup. Maybe yeah. Something goes weird. I said Jurassic one, Solo two. Ocean's 8 could maybe sneak in. Obviously, very wrong in the Solo in Ocean's 8, but I think I'm right on the Jurassic Park as the champ, right? Well, is that the biggest of the summer?
Yes. Yes, because we don't do biggest against budget. We just do biggest. Right. And so Jurassic is the biggest.
Yeah. But meanwhile, I think one of the movies that came out that's outside of the summer is just crushing them all now, right?
Which one is that?
Or maybe it's just before. I'm trying to think. What's been the biggest movies of the year?
The Avengers.
Yeah, that Infinity War.
And I think Black Panther made a bag of cash as well.
That's really a long time ago, Black Panther.
I know, but it's still this calendar year, which kind of proves...
But anyway, Fantastic Beasts just did $253 million in its opening weekend.
Really?
Oh, that's global, though.
Yeah. Which I think... It is interesting. Summer is sort of... I don't want to beat the Star Wars thing to death, but because we talk about Star Wars so much on this show, we came back there and you made a comment when we were just doing the scores just now. You made a comment that Disney are going to reevaluate their whole Star Wars strategy on the back of Solo. I also think too that the studios in general, I think we are seeing this trend that they are no longer going all in on the summer. Which was the case 10 years
ago. And we just talked about the summer breaking down. We were always talking about that.
And again, when you've just said the biggest movies of the year, neither one of them are summer movies. And what the interesting thing is that would not have been the case 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. And I can't decide. I'm not ready to sit and make this pronouncement right now. But we are definitely getting to the moment where, you know, do we... as the fourth estate or fifth estate, which we probably are, do you have to reevaluate how important summer is at all? And that's the interesting thing. Again, the biggest movie of the summer, the two biggest movies of the summer, one's comic book and one's dinosaurs, are still smaller than, now of course these numbers are huge, but they're still smaller than, they're not the top two movies of the year.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think Star Wars is almost emblematic of that because, again, Star Wars have sort of switched to this Christmas thing, which has done very well for them. And so Solo's, you know, we've had so much discussion, and you can go back to that 11th of May show from 2016 to really listen to my partner go back and forth on the idea of a Solo movie. But Solo, in its strange way, is a microcosm of summer blockbusters. Mm-hmm. It's not that big. It's not.
Yeah. No, and even like there's a sheet on Box Office Mojo that has both the international and domestic, and it's pretty interesting stats there where the percentage that different movies do. Like, so Venom did very well globally, but only 26% of his money was domestic. So they're at $780 million overall. Deadpool 2 is up about the same global numbers, actually a little behind Venom, but 43% was done domestically. So you can tell, like, what are people's tastes run to, and you can kind of... That's not too surprising.
Yeah.
That something like Deadpool would really be more of an American movie and it's goofy kind of comedy stuff. The Meg did only 27% domestically.
And it's up at big numbers overall. Rampage isn't actually in the top 15 overall internationally, but only 23% of its money, only $9.99
If someone comes in and says, hey, we're all going to the cinema to see the Mark Wahlberg, Dwayne Johnson double act movie, avoid that.
Yeah.
Because those two dudes who I like a lot, they both failed this summer. So again, I win 2018.
Yeah.
I think that is it for our sort of movie show. Again, we will look in the blog. We will have the link to the original article about the Washington Post had about what the new classics sort of were. It's a great article and really interesting if you like films. Again, we discussed it for half an hour.
Useful for the holidays.
Useful for the holidays. Talking of holidays, I think the next time you hear us, we'll be doing our Christmas special.
Yeah, we just have to figure out what it is.
Yes, exactly. This has been the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at Libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at AtlanticVoice.net. Email us at AtlanticVoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for The Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.